Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Chris Shunk, guest hosting today for the 300th episode, and I'm joined, as always, by Dan Roth. Dano, what's up, man?
Good evening. I wanted to remind everybody that the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, your online source for tires and wheels and upgrades. So check them out, TireRack.com. And, so moving on to everybody else.
All right, Chris Parker, what's going on?
Not too much. Proud to be here on your number 300.
It's like my number 250 or something like that. Okay, and we've got Zach Bowman. Zach might be on for a short amount of time because he's on the road. And, Zach, you're doing something cool right now. What is it?
Hey, guys. Yeah, I'm just going to hop on and say congratulations on the 300th episode. It's freaking awesome. It's always good to hear Mr. Shank on our podcast. We met him daily. I 7 hours ago, I bought a Mazda Miata, and I have been driving I-75 north ever since. So, doing well, but I'm in the middle of a rainstorm, and I'm about to drop it into the labyrinth that is down by Atlanta on the interstate. So I'm going to bow out for the rest of the show, but you guys have a blast. I can't wait to hear it.
All right. Take care, right. Zachy.
Thanks, Zachy.
Congrats on the new car.
Again, what year was the Miata that he got?
The 06.
Nice. That's the newer. That's the new body style. First year of the new body style? Or the current body style, I should say?
Good. Very cool. It's got a 16 manual and a limited slip. And of course, the top goes down. It's a nice touch, I think. Not now, because it's fucking raining. I mean, it's freaking raining.
Even while he's driving, he manages to drop the inevitable podcast F-bomb. All right, Zach, get driving.
Yeah. A million hours
of sound cut out there. or might in the post-editing.
Yeah. We'll see. All right. Take it easy, Zach.
I don't see him.
See you.
Bye.
Glad that hacks off the show.
Oh, come on now.
All right, so obviously I no longer work for Autoblog, and everybody knows on the podcast that I got a job at GM. So I wanted to say up front that I am not a spokesman for GM. I'm just coming on as Chris, saying hi to the guys, and want to be part of this show. Obviously, something very cool to get the 300. So it's funny because I just got back from the Atlanta area last week. And
yes, because they were showing you all the new stuff. So what's the new stuff?
I have absolutely no idea. I'm an IT guy. They don't show me new stuff, nor will they talk to me as much as I've tried. What I was doing is we were down for a recruiting trip, and I actually made the tool for the recruiting trip. So I was supporting my IT nerd stuff. That's why I was down there. But when I was down there and we were talking to the kids, you know, we keep hearing these news flashes that these Gen Y kids don't care about cars. Kid, and I call them kids, they're like 20, 22 years old.
The news flashes are wrong.
Right, but what they were said, like, kid after kid is like, yeah, I'm in club racing, or I'm in SCCA, and I mean, they were like in male and female, too. And I'm sitting there, and I'm supporting Tool, and these people are getting into arguments over Kendrick Motorsports and, you know, NASCAR, which I have no idea what they're talking about because it's NASCAR, but it was just really cool to see that these kids were really jazzed up about cars. So
yeah. Were they jazzed up about any GM cars?
I didn't remember specifically. A lot of kids were asking about Corvettes and Camaros, of course, because they're kids. But like I said, I was just doing my IT geek stuff, and I wasn't really talking to them. I was just more observing. So, all right, let's move on to the Autoblog Garage. Dan, what do you have?
This week I have a 2012 Volvo S60 T5 all-wheel drive.
Some things never change. Yeah, the Volvo.
It's not mine. Although it's really interesting, I feel like that one of those crusty old guys is like, ah, the old ones have all the charm. The new ones, just they're not the same. This car, it is the sweet spot for the S60, the T5 with the all-wheel drive. It's like $38,000 the way this one's equipped, and it's a pretty nice car, and it feels more Volvo than the T6 does, which is just, it's almost one of those cars that's just too powerful, whereas this is just right. It's sort of the everyman Volvo, very much in keeping with the somewhat milquetoast S60 of yore. And the 2.5 liter engine is really smooth. I'm really impressed with how much they've smoothed it out, even though it's still the 5, so it sort of has that odd thrum. And the rest of the car, you know, the interior is nice. It's really comfortable. I just don't think it has the same sort of styling flair that my cars have. So, there.
Let me guess. Is it white with orangey leather interior?
It is indeed. Is this the same one you've driven?
It is the exact same. They spec'd all of the cars exactly the same at the launch in Park City, Utah. So you may actually be driving the very car that I drove.
Did you like
hollowed ground?
Yeah, did you stick your bubble gum under the seat or something?
Well, a little snot, but you know, it's you know probably deteriorated by now.
That's okay. They've reconned the cars before they. No, I mean it's fine. I wouldn't trade my cars for my cars are a little bit less refined, but they're. You know,
a little bit, Dan.
Yeah. Okay. So they're.
I'm sure you've taken good care of them, but they have lasted 10 years.
Yeah, I've taken good care of them. My car's been sitting in the driveway for 2 months with no brakes. Yeah, great care. No, it's sort of gotten a little bit more. It's a Mondeo with Volvo styling on it, and that's. It feels that way where, you know, so I feel like some of the charm is gone and maybe that's just me being biased. And in fact, that's probably just me being biased.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and call the ball on that and say that that's probably what it is. I was surprised at how good this car is.
It is good. It's for 38 grand.
Especially for the money, right? And that's the thing right there. Now, your car doesn't have nav if it's the same thing, but it's all-wheel drive. It's 250 horsepower and even more torque. And it puts up pretty good performance numbers.
Yeah, it has a momentary overboost function, so you'll get more power out of it when you need it. You know, in terms of just a general refinement in European vehicle, it's pretty good. And the price, you know, try to find a BMW that's loaded this way with xDrive.
It has all-wheel drive, and it's still 38.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very well priced for what it is. So much so, I was kind of surprised. I'd driven the S60, you know, when it first came out, not with the T5 all-wheel drive because they didn't have that combination yet. But revisiting it again and driving it on real roads and all that, I kind of went home and was thinking like, yeah, we need a new car for my girlfriend, and that would be a stretch. But that's a stretch that I could live with more than like some, you know, $35,000 Escape or something like that.
Well, you know, and they don't make Saabs anymore, so you're kind of stuck with your affinity for Swedish iron. You're that's it.
Well, it's not really the Swedish part. It's the just out of the mainstream part that I kind of like.
Yeah, it still is that. And, you know, it's beautifully designed. The interior especially is really nicely designed, and the materials are a definite step up over the last generation of S60, which sort of got crappier the longer they built it. So in all respects, it's a better car. It rides really nicely. I honestly think that if I were to drive this back-to-back with the T6, I'd love the power of the T6, but this car just, it is, like I said, it's the sweet spot. It really gels. This is the right one to get, I think, for most people.
And the price tag, not bad. All right, Chris, what do you have?
I have a Nissan GTR, but it just arrived.
What? You have something exotic? That's bizarre.
I know.
Things are the same. It's been 2.5 months, but I don't think much changed.
Well, actually, I just got the GTR, so I haven't really driven it more than like 5 miles, so I'd rather not talk about that. We'll reserve that for a future podcast. But I actually had a Panamera GTS that just left this morning that I drove all week. So,
Tough life.
Mainstream. That's cool.
That's a Panamera GTS. Yes, a four-door Porsche with a V8 is more mainstream.
Well, it actually probably is more mainstream. I hadn't driven the GTS before. I had driven an S and the hybrid. And I really have to say this is definitely my favorite, and not just because it's got the great naturally aspirated V8 and plenty of power. It's amazing how well this car handles. And I don't know what the deal is, if they've made some updates for the 2013 model year to PDK, but the little like slow speed tractability issues that I felt before were pretty much gone. And it just, it's just a really nice package. It's incredibly expensive as options. A GTS starts at 111,000. Mine was over 140K, which is, you know, a lot of cash, but it's still ugly, but it drove beautifully.
You know, I had a Porsche last week, and everybody got on my case because I thought that the $90,000 that it cost was...
Which one was it that you had?
The Boxster S.
That's a lot of money.
$90K for a Boxster is a lot of money.
It was really nicely equipped, though.
I hope so.
It was... No, it doesn't feel nuts when you drive that car. I do also have to say on the Boxster S tip, Worcester, Massachusetts, Sunderland Road, and Grafton Street, you got to pave that, because I had an incident with the Porsche because you guys have left the manhole covers up for 2 months, and I hit one. And,
oh.
Yeah, unhappy. Unhappy.
Damn.
What am I paying taxes for?
That was a personal message,
wasn't
it?
Did you bend a wheel?
It took a nick out of the rim. And interesting note, no spare tire in a Porsche. Little tiny inflator kit with some sealant. And big warnings to say, only for minor things. Only use if the sidewall is not damaged. Guess what? When you hit a manhole cover thing like that, it damages the sidewall. Puts a nice slice in it against the wheel, and yeah. So.
Ouch. That's actually happened to me with my own car in the past. And
yeah, me too.
That gouge is still there.
Yeah.
All right.
Roadside assistance is pretty badass, though.
It can't hurt when you get a Porsche anything. You know, it's funny because I was listening to McElroy. He had a Porsche because he's on 950, and he said that the 911 Turbo S, I believe it was, that he had was 185 grand, and his kind of is like I was like hyperventilating from that thought. And at the very end, he's like, "The more expensive they make them, the more people buy them." I'm like, "Well, more power to you, because if it's working, go for it."
I did not have a problem with an expensive Porsche because it felt like it was still worth every penny.
All right, how about Chris? So, with like, what was your overall impression compared to the other Porsches? I don't care about fuel economy on this one because it's a GTI.
Yeah, I didn't even honestly pay attention to the fuel economy. It's just, like I said, I mean, I think it's probably the best Panamera I've driven. And this is the premier driving four-door. It's not a sedan, it's a hatchback, and it's pretty useful. It's, you know, I would take it over a 7 Series, but of course, 140K buys you a really nice B7 with probably all kinds of extras. I don't know. I mean, it's you know, it's something that's not going to please everybody, and it's not supposed to, but it does a really good job. I mean, it's actually now with the PDK, it's easy to drive. Just stick it in D and just pot around in traffic, and you don't really get any of that dual clutch shunt. It drives around fine, but then when you want to wail on it, it actually doesn't feel hugely powerful, which is funny because it's got, I think, a 420 horsepower in 0 to 60s in the low fours. It doesn't feel that quick, maybe because it's that big, but when you take it on a winding road, the whole car just kind of shrink wraps around you, and it does not feel anywhere near the size that it is.
Huh.
And that's not a bad thing, because the car looks big on the outside, but everybody who's ever driven it tells me it like feels smaller once you're inside.
It is big on the outside, and it's big on the inside. They just managed to make it drive quite well.
They Porsche'd it.
Yeah.
So I am actually, we have a program at GM. It's called the Ambassador Program. If you work there, you could try out any car you want for like a week. like every quarter.
So you had a DR1 like first thing?
No, so like of course if you follow it at all, you know that the Corvettes go first, and then the CTS-Vs go second, and then the Camaros go third, or somewhere in there, like 1, 2, and 3, they get mixed up. But whatever, really quickly you can't get them. So since I started in July, I didn't have a lot of time to get something for the first quarter. But I've always wanted to drive the SRX with the 3.6. Because I haven't, because I reviewed it when it first came. I did the first drive for it, and it had the 3 liter, and then I did another first drive for it with the 2.8 turbo, but I'd never driven the one with the 3.6. So I just got it today, but it definitely feels a lot more peppy than the 3 liter that I had a couple years ago. But the 3.6 is one of my favorites anyway, so it's doing pretty well. But like I said, I only drove it 20 miles, but. So that was kind of cool. Like, I'm really excited about the next one because I did manage to get a CTS-V for, I think, November. So
perfect time of year for that.
Exactly. Well, you know what? Hopefully it's like last winter and it's you get the opportunity to have some fun. I'm pretty sure I can't do anything stupid in those cars, especially that I would publicly admit to. And I'm not going to do anything dumb with the SRX, but I don't know if I can resist the burnout in the CTS-V. We'll see what I can do. The cool thing is, like, you know how, like, with the media vehicles, nobody can drive them. The point of giving us the cars is they want us to get other people to drive them so they can try them out.
That's going
to
be weird.
It is weird. It's a completely different. Instead of like, no, it's mine, you can't have it. It's no, you have to drive it. So one of my neighbors across the street, you know, saw that I got it, and I brought him over and I took him for a ride, and then he was like, "Can I drive it?" I'm like, "Absolutely." So he drove it home, and he liked it a lot. So it's a cool program, and I'm just glad that it's like that. You start to hyperventilate from only driving one car, and I am still driving the Volvo for now until I could find something from GM that I want.
Wait a minute. You did not swipe your daughter's new car?
I gave her the Cruise. So I bought her a Cruise, and then I was kind of like, well, I've got to buy myself something now, but I want to try out the Verano Turbo, and I want to try the 2.0 Turbo ATS before I make any decision. So I draw the line. I really like the idea of having the 2 liter turbo in the shunt garage. So that, to me, like, in terms of engine and torque and weight and all that, it sounds like a great combination. So obviously I haven't driven any of them yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. So it's narrowed down to that. It's a little bit different because in the past I've told you guys, even when I was there, I was like kind of pro-American being from Detroit. Everybody knew that about me, but now I'm like a GM guy, so it feels like it's like picking the Lions or the Tigers. You have to stay on the one team. So like, I still see like a black Mustang GT and with tinted windows and black wheels, and I'm like, ooh. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, I like the Camaro too. So I like liking it's one thing, but buying it and driving it to work is a dumb idea. So anyways, as far as I've been doing IT stuff that I'm not going to bore anybody with, and we don't get to talk about cars. And actually, I spent a lot more time on Autoblog, and one of my favorite, you guys hired some people. I always like Seth, so I was really excited to see that he was writing, and just it's really cool, like, wanting to see the news again because you weren't in the middle of it all the time. And the auto show season is like a complete mystery to me, and I'm really looking forward to the Paris Auto Show. So actually, we'll start with that first out of the gate. A lot of stuff coming, Chris. This obviously tough times are tough in Europe, but you know, best way to cheer people up is with a lot of new products.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The economic atmosphere is very depressed, and Paris has usually got a little bit more style and swagger to it than some of the other shows. Geneva, you get the supercars, but you also get a really heavy green message. At Paris, you get, you know, the wacky French concepts and all of that. I think it's the economic condition is probably too recent to really influence a lot of the vehicles that we're going to see there. For instance, we're probably going to see the McLaren F1 successor, known as P12. But we're also seeing a lot more real-world stuff. BMW showing a concept active tour, which is supposed to be like the plug-in 1 Series hatchback. And Lexus just announced today that they have a new concept coming, the LFCC, which looks an awful lot like a coupe version of an IS with a big spindle grille on the front. So So there should be plenty to go around.
All right, Dan, what do you have? What have you seen so far that you like? Obviously, a lot of the Peugeots of the world, or as I like to call it, Peugeot.
Peugeot.
Bad English is.
Well, up here in New England, we have a Native American tribe called the Pequots, which is pretty close. They have a casino now. I don't think you'll find a Peugeot casino, but I believe the casino was a deer. There was some car. Anyway, I find this the strangest thing to admit. That little smart concept that's like a little 4x4 crossover thing actually looks pretty cool.
The electric Suzuki X90?
Yeah. I always liked the X90.
Detroit last year or something like that in Detroit, Chris?
They did something white, but it wasn't really like off-road and sort of as tough. I think that was the 4Vision concept.
Uh-huh.
I think we're running out of 4s.
Yeah, I think they're like 6 and 8.
Yeah.
So the one I wanted to talk about was definitely something I wanted to talk about with Dan, because I'd like to see his reaction.
Are you going to try to make me mad?
The Peugeot Onyx. It's your kind of supercar. I think it looks really... The paint job is what gets me.
That black and tan thing?
Yeah, it's like it's black and gold. What a cool... And it's like that matte black. It just looks wild to me.
Yeah, I looked at that and I was like, okay, that's clearly a rendering because... Well, I mean, they could build something that looks like that on the show stand for sure, but it looks like a Transformer prop.
Maybe that's why I like it. I don't know.
the concept cards with the white interior, this looks like it has like some sort of like 80s pseudo stone interior. So I don't know. Maybe it's like a Coke den inside. I'm not sure. And
we can only hope, Dan.
Yeah. Well, it's got plenty of flat expanses for which, never mind. I love the French. I mean, their style.
Why is the dashboard mirrored?
Yeah. No, those aren't credit cards. No. The French with their styling, like, I mean, they have a word for something like this. It's called outre. I mean, we don't have a word like that. We use the French word. And this is rather outre. And I do dig it. They'll never build it, of course.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you never know, but it's probably not going to happen.
Although, you know, with Peugeot's new tie-up with Chevrolet and General Motors, maybe we're looking at the new Corvette.
Put that in your rumor mill and smoke it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the rumor mill. It seems like it's going hog wild right now. But it seems like this at this point is like with the auto shows, it's kind of like right before the iPhone comes out, that everybody's speculating on what it's going to do, and then somebody always speculates these wild things that
Doesn't
you know are never going to happen.
Over babies and stuff?
Like, you even have a smartphone yet, Dan?
I do, actually.
What? Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh my God! Time is changing. I know. I saw some white hairs in my goatee. Now this, between the two, I don't know what to think.
Just pleased to see hairs.
Yeah,
it was hair on my chin. So yeah. I mean.
I mean, we should get back to though the LFCC because we've had questions about the IS when that's coming with Lexus having done all its other. You know, there's a new GS, there's a new LS. This thing to me looks an awful lot like the IS styling cues with a really horrendous grill that kind of looks like more like a mouth with like the bottom lip where that little string that attaches the lip to the gums is sort of like not there. So it just kind of like flaps down. That's what it looks like to me. It's just like that video of the guy in the centrifuge where his face just gets distorted after a while.
Yeah, it's Jeremy Clarkson, the Ariel Adam.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, look, I don't think that the production car will have that much grill. If only, you know, it'll need a proper bumper. And I suppose you could hide one back there, but it seems sort of unlikely. This is sort of the... super concept look and just trying to integrate that form into all of their cars, which I think they've actually done a fairly good job of to this point. Sometimes it's sort of rough when you're in a transition to a new styling language where you're appending a new form, especially a grill, onto an old shape. Like we saw when Audi went to the horse collar single frame grill, I think that was really awkward for a while and sort of blighted some pretty minimalist and spare design that was really elegant, but they finally figured it out. I don't know that that's what Lexus is struggling with here. I mean, we're looking at a concept, but it's going to take them a while to really figure that out.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Paris, too, is like that's one of the cars that we're going to see. There's a lot of stuff here that we're just never going to lay eyes on, which I think is the exciting part about it. Do we have somebody going to Paris?
Oh, yeah. We have a whole crew going, led by Steve Ewing. I will be sitting on the sidelines and enjoying not being in the Paris Media Center.
Come on. There's not Courcoisier and Galois, those are the strongest
effects? No, there's nothing there other than body odor and heat. there's not even Wi-Fi.
No, really? I thought other countries were ahead of us with Wi-Fi.
Yes, they are, but the French, in my experience, they basically put you outside of the exhibition hall in a two-story, double-wide trailer kind of thing that they build just for the show. And, you know, it's actually not a bad show to walk around. There's a lot of cool stuff going on there. It's not as unwalkable as, say, like the Frankfurt show. But I won't miss trying to cover the show because that media center is just, not to sound like an entitled journalist, but it makes your job very, very difficult.
There's always the difference because before I worked in the media, I used to think whiny entitled journalists. But then when you're actually in the suit and you're doing it, so there are times like when I was at SEMA in 08 that you think this isn't human. It's not good working conditions because you still have to do your job, but it's not helping you. So yeah, there is a time when you just kind of have to put up the white flag.
I thought that's why they put chairs in the media center, though, so you could toss them around. And white flag in France, what goes better?
Dan, I swear to God, I thought you almost were going to do that, and I threw it up there, and I'm like, man, first the white beard, and then he's driving a Volvo, and then...
come on, you handed it to me on a platter, Chris.
You did. Yeah, you did get it. You got some serious underhand toss right there. Okay, so let's go to the spy shots with the M3, because I think... This is kind of like the iPhone in that people like to guess and speculate on what's going to be under the hood. And how do you get a picture of this, Chris? How does this happen?
That's a very good question, how it happened. I don't think these were leaks because usually you can kind of infer from what the spy shooters tell you that maybe they got a good look at it. It could be that it was parked on the side of a road somewhere that Brenda Pretty and company had been following the car and it had been left open while they were working on it or whatever, and she just kind of ran by with her camera and took some snapshots. But these are actually very, very good snapshots.
Yeah, like they were on top of it.
They're in focus, and there are a number of angles, so it is kind of curious. There is, you know, always the outside possibility that it's an intentional leak by BMW, but I think at this point, I'm not sure what they would gain from that. So I think they're probably...
How could it not be? I mean, this is like when you're at work and you're on the security team and you leave your laptop open and you don't hit Control-Alt-Delete and hit Enter, so that they're going to send something to the vice president with your IM. That's what happens. But you don't do this with a prototype of the M3. It doesn't happen.
Well, and here's the reason why I don't know that this is that this was staged, because as big as that cross brace is, the sort of V-shaped brace, that does not look like a final production piece to me. And in fact, a lot of the engine compartment doesn't look quite final production, and I don't know that they would want to show all that off.
Right, that's true. That's true. Especially
it looks like a pretty rough casting.
Yeah. It looks like it's stuffed in there. I mean, are people saying it's the 3 liter?
The conjecture is that it's the 3 liter with two or possibly three turbochargers on it. And there's a video that's attached to the post where it goes around and it definitely sounds like a badass 6, and that's about all you can infer from the video. We'll find out soon enough what this thing actually packs in terms of horsepower, but if history has been our guide, they're going to rate it at something that's actually less than what it's putting out as well, especially for the M3.
I do love that they do that. I mean, I would rather be pleasantly surprised than for them to over-deliver. And they do a better job of that than most manufacturers.
Yeah.
What about this talk about the maybe it being bored out to 3.3 liters? I mean, that to me sounds more like an M engine, because isn't that what they did with the old inline six? They bored out to 3.2.
But that was before turbos. Turbos cure all that.
Right.
And with turbos, you actually want a little bit more cylinder bore thickness. You want more cylinder wall thickness because of the pressure. So,
right, but don't they, I mean, if you're pressurizing it to 450 horsepower or whatever, I'm sure you're right. But don't they use like those super hard sleeves or whatever to
Nickel or whatever?
Yeah,
it's still do aluminum, so it's not doesn't weigh 400 pounds on the block.
Right, but see that's the thing though. When you've got that's a very thin surface that's deposited by plasma or whatever, I forget exactly how it works, but that's a really, really thin surface. Think of it like a veneer. And so when you've got a bunch of boost going in there, it is going to distort, especially when you get up and higher revs and stuff. So you're going to want thicker cylinder walls. You could bore it out, sure, but I think that it would not last quite as long. And BMW has other issues they want to conquer rather than doing lots and lots of engine swaps, I'm sure.
All I heard after you said plasma, because I was like, New England Austin Powers. That's all I could think of.
Why?
Because you're like, with plasma. No,
those are sharks with frickin' laser beams.
Okay. I was off a little bit on that one.
Today on Dan Missing the Joke Theater.
I can picture you seeing the promo for Austin Powers, like, I'm not going to watch that garbage.
I saw the first one, and the sequels I did not need to see.
You saw all you needed to see.
Yep.
All right, so when does the M3 hit the streets? Do we have any clue yet?
Frankfurt, right? We're going to see it in Frankfurt?
That's, I think, been the leading intelligence. But
a year from now? Is it a year from now in Frankfurt?
That's been my understanding, but, I mean, who knows? It could show up at Paris.
Yeah, I mean, wow. So just think about it. If it showed up in Frankfurt in a year, this engine would not be, they wouldn't just slap that picture out there. I think I agree with you. That's a long way to go.
I think we need to call up Brenda and actually ask her the story behind these pictures. Maybe we could get a good tidbit for the site. Or maybe she'd tell us, I'm not giving you any of my secrets, boys. Click.
I won't do that, but you can. But all I know about Brenda is I randomly walked up to her and said, hey, lady, can you take a picture of us at the Detroit Auto Show last year? And everybody just laughed their asses off. And she turned around, I'm like, that's Brenda Pretty. Okay. I can see the joke. But when she had her back turned to me, I had no idea.
I just remember when she was taking pictures of us in the media room, like joking once. I don't know how many years ago it was, but there were some like potted plants or whatever, and we had to go like hide in the plants so that the shots were through the bushes, kind of.
Very clever. Funny. She got to admit that it's her job sounds cool, but it also sounds like you would have to have a very large portion of like patience.
Yeah.
I don't think I could ever have.
Not having patience? Come on.
Yeah.
You know, like, when I was a kid, it was one of my most fervent desires to be Hans Lehmann, you know, to hang out, you know, of cars and hang in trees and go up to the Arctic Circle and all that and see all the cars before everyone else did.
Did you ever want to be Hans Gruber?
No, because, you know, skyscrapers and falling, not so much anymore.
Yippee-ki-yay. All right. Let's move on to the next story. Ford's Farley. I just love the fact that I can come back as the guest and still be the host, because it's easiest, because now I know less about cars than ever. All right. So anyways, Ford's Farley addresses the burden of being Lincoln. Obviously, you know, the Lincoln subject has been pretty hot, Dan, and Farley, was it Farley that actually said that something about the burden of being Lincoln? Was he the one who brought it up in the first place?
Yeah, he was explaining that the burden of being Lincoln is sort of the fact that nobody pays attention to them, and they really need to shift that to a large degree to be successful. You know, they haven't really been hot so much as, like, they've been through like the hot flash stage, and now they're just sort of fallow. And that's pretty much where Lincoln is right now, and they need to bring forth some sales. So I'm not sure what his plan really entails. It sounds kind of haphazard. The idea is that they're launching this new marketing campaign, and it's going to kick off very soon with a concert that is webcast live, as if that's going to make me want to buy a car. And a Lincoln specifically, like, I know that they're trying to connect with buyers, especially younger buyers, and they're also renaming themselves Lincoln Motor Company because that seems like something that younger people would be interested in. But
you got funnier, Dan, or I just miss you. I don't know. What's
you, miss me.
One.
You know what? Why don't you call me later tonight? When you call me later tonight, I'll whisper in your ear, I promise.
So Milazzo's been pinging me with a lot of stuff, and he says that from the August 24th interview in Auto News. It says Lincoln has fallen so far off the radars that many customers, this is from Farley, for many customers that conventional campaign for arrival of a new model won't suffice. So they're talking about the MKZ. One car that does well alone could not do it.
He's right. He's right that a traditional web, you know, a traditional launch campaign is not going to work. That's true for any car now, and that's really true for a brand that's been this sort of quiet. Even when they tried to make noise, they're quiet. And while I don't agree that the MKZ is really a product that's going to shift much, because they say that their current buyer age, the average is at 65 right now, which is pretty old in the industry. It may be the oldest, and they want to. They're casting this wide net. Like, well, we want to get the 35 to 40 year old, or 35 to 50. Let me tell you, being on the cusp of being 35, Lincoln has got to do something way better than the MKZ and that milquetoast redo that only looks good from your favorite angle. before I'm interested in it, and it's going to be a great car.
Tells me it's going to take you decades to be interested in Lincoln.
That is not
just
true.
Because you're aging, but because, you know, nobody's driven that car yet. We don't know how good it is.
Well, I mean, see, here's the thing that I was talking about with Zach before we were on, and it's almost like if the new MKZ had been the Fusion, people would have accepted it, and if the new Fusion had been the Lincoln, it would have been like, wow. But I understand how that clearly didn't happen. So the Fusion is really outshining the Lincoln, and it probably is a very good car. I don't disagree that it's going to be a really good driving car. It's going to be...
When does it come out?
Soon.
Yeah, it should be very soon. But here's the other thing about that. Like, I think we're sort of stuck in the auto journalist land of knowing that those two cars are basically the same. I think that the target audience that they will end up courting is probably the Lexus demographic. You know, that's probably who they want, like a slightly younger buyer, but that same sort of vehicular attributes, you know, the quiet and the comfortable ride and that sort of deal. And those people don't know that their cars are based on Toyotas, and most people don't. So I think the hardest part for them is going to be for people to think about it. So they've got to get butts in seats when they have a new product like the MKZ. So I don't know if they need to have Farley and Mulally offering free taxi rides outside of the Lexus and Mercedes dealers or what. But that's what they need to start with. And people have been asking us on the podcast seemingly every single week, is the MKZ the car that you know, saves Lincoln or that starts the turnaround? It's going to take decades, you know, several model, full model cycles for anybody to even figure out if they're going in the right direction. I mean, we talked about this before, but Cadillac as a brand up until this year has basically been the CTS brand with maybe a little SRX thrown in since the Escalade kind of lost its luster. And now it's got the ATS and it's got the XTS. So there's some movement there, but they basically had one product, you know, to one and a half products to sell for a real long time. And we've been talking about how revitalized Cadillac has been for how long now?
They've been revitalized, in our opinion.
Right.
They're still
not where they need to be.
Right, exactly. And no, so I think you're right. I think that the MKZ is going to compete very well with the Lexus ES, which is got to be its target. And, you know, I said this a while ago, too, is that's where they have to bring it, because they don't have a platform. They're not going to get one to compete against the CTS and the Germans, and that's really not where they need to be. There's plenty of those cars. You know, there's Infiniti and there's Lexus as well in that space. Everybody's trying to be that sort of classic luxury sports sedan, but people are buying lots and lots of Lexus ES models, and those that do know that it's a Toyota, that's a good thing. So
are they really selling a lot of those? I haven't been looking at the numbers at all.
I mean, the RX is probably their top seller, but the ES,
right.
It's the ES, RX, and everything else.
Right. I remember in the old days, even a couple of years ago, those two were like really, really high numbers, but then they dropped off. But I haven't looked since the new ES came out. Is that like fully in dealerships? I thought I drove by a Lexus dealer and I saw a couple up front. I don't know how long they've been out there.
I think they're just starting to go in now. And I think the dealership thing, that's another really key part of the experience that I don't quite know how they're going to address, because the Lexus dealer network is still pretty well state-of-the-art in terms of the age of the brick-and-mortar facilities and the way they treat customers and all that stuff. And Lincoln, as best I can remember, they don't have exactly the most up-to-date dealership network, and I think their dealers have been loath to invest a lot more money because they haven't had real product to sell, especially since they lost volume in Mercury. So if they have old-school dealers with old-school plants and old-school mindsets, they're going to have a really hard time. So they've got to reinvent their dealer experience, or maybe kind of find a way to do without it. Like, you know, Hyundai messed around with the Equus with the concierge service, and we had some experience with that where it wasn't completely hitchless. But if they could find a way to get the pickup and delivery thing going where you didn't even have to go to the dealer, or even if you're up north and, you know, you offered snow tire storage and fitment and pickup and drop off, some way to, you know, some sort of service that nobody else offers. That's a good way to get people to reconsider your brand.
Yeah, I think that those are all things that Farley has talked about needing to do. They're definitely going to step it up with a concierge so that you can at least arrange a test drive. They're going to want to get lots and lots of the vehicles out and into people's hands. So that's really going to shift a lot of opinion right there, is just driving the cars. And, you know, Lincoln does have a way to go. This could be the first step. They're going to have to do something to, you know, follow it up, or it's just going to die. So.
You brought up the dealer network, Chris, and something that, like, they're always talking about how much money they have to spend, and I guess Crane Detroit was mentioning that, this is from Alonzo, that Ford says that these guys have to spend $1 million or step aside. But the thing about it is, like, what about a luxury car? What do you want out of your dealership? And is it really going to make the difference for you if you're in the market for a new car, say a $40,000 Lincoln MKZ? What do they have to do to be different? I mean, is it coffee at the
no,
three loaner cars? And
everybody
all that
does that.
What is it?
Toyota does that now. I mean, it's, I don't know. I'll let Chris answer first. So.
I think it's a lot of those little things. It's courtesy. It's the way you're spoken to when you walk in. It's the materials you're surrounded in. It's the free extras, like the coffee or like the loaner car service. It's sort of effortless. The best dealership is the one you sort of forget about, right? Or maybe, you know, you've got such a over the top experience that it becomes like your customer service point of reference. But most of the time, I think people just don't want to think about the dealers a whole lot. And most of the time, we all remember the dealers from feeling like we got screwed when we bought the car, or the time when we feel like we got fleeced for a service deal, or
right,
a dingy showroom, or, you know, something like that. And you just want it to be as transparent as possible.
Yeah, I mean, if you go into a lot of dealerships, you'll notice that most of them now they've got, you know, stuff to munch on, and they've got water and stuff. So when we go to shoot at some of our dealership clients, I make sure that I hit the Panera pastries.
Right.
And I help myself to a couple that are meant for the customers, but that's okay.
Yep, good job.
And a free coffee, and here's some waters. Excellent.
No, I, you know, the last time I went to the dealership was in July, and it was like, hey, here's a coupon for a free oil change. Here's, you know, here's meet the service manager. Here's whatever they had, coffee and all that stuff. And it was a good experience. Like, I remember 10 years ago, it wasn't so good, but I was buying a Chevy. I wasn't buying a, you know, a Lexus or a Lincoln or a Cadillac.
But see, that's the thing, though. Like, you're spending a huge amount of money on a Chevy. So why should they treat you like crap just because you're not buying a Lexus or a Lincoln or a Cadillac?
Right, but I mean, you're talking about an $18,000 car versus a $38,000 or $40,000 car. So how, if the Chevy and the Toyota dealer, like you said, are doing it, then what do they do? And I'm not saying that I have a right or wrong answer. I just don't know. I don't know if that's going
to
help them.
I think what they need to do is they need to very closely see what Lexus has done, and because Lexus dealer service has always gotten raves, and that's because they treat people like they're human, for the most part. I mean, there's dirtbags in every sort of dealer organization, just because there's those like old school dealer guys that just whatever. But the other thing they need to do, and I think that they should do this because they're at that level with their luxury product. This is how they differentiate themselves from Ford, is that they do a lot more handholding. You know, and it's not just because the customer is typically an older customer. It's just that's the experience that, you know, oh, he answered my questions. They were there online, and we scheduled it. I came in, and we talked. It was easy. It was convenient. Their hours make a big difference. All of those things, like having dealt with car dealerships recently when I was flirting with a purchase, and I decided, hey, you know what, I don't want to deal with this right now.
So it worked for you.
I just found myself wanting more convenience. Like, listen, I have the chunk of money to buy, but if it's on your terms, that's turnoff to me.
All right, let's move on from the dealership / Lincoln conversation to the new Jeep Cherokee and Grand Wagoneer. These are a couple of names that I'm sure Jeep guys really remember, because I mean, I remember growing up as a kid looking at the Wagoneer and thinking, wow, that is huge and wonderful. And the Jeep Cherokee, I remember the best year it ever had was the year they canceled it. So obviously there was some demand for that back in the day, Dan.
The Cherokee or the Wagoneer was the best year they had when they canceled?
No, the Cherokee was the Cherokee.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's because everybody wanted to get their Chrysler Death Trap before they couldn't make them anymore. I loved the XJ Cherokee, but that thing was straight up dangerous on the road by the time.
I just remember it having a really surprisingly small back seat.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that stood out for me. Because I remember I had a boss who bought a purple one, just loved that car. He bragged about it incessantly, and then he made us all go to lunch and just sardined in there.
A purple one, so that was like a Cherokee Sport.
Yes.
Yeah. When the chiclet colors. That vehicle was beloved by many, and it'll come back. I mean, this isn't exactly any new information that Automotive News is sort of giving us out here. There's going to be a new vehicle that replaces the Patriot and replaces the Liberty, I'm sorry, and it's going to be called the Cherokee. They're going, well, I think
the Grand Wagoneer is a lot bigger, though, right?
But the Grand Wagoneer is going to be the Durango replacement, I believe, or sort
that's
of
what
Durango
they said
based.
Too.
Yeah. I think because if they're going to kill the Durango on the Dodge side, and they're not going to, you know, make it a Chrysler, which look at Chrysler now, there's only like three products that Chrysler has. What head scratcher. And so they're going to want to have that three row ability, and Automotive News and Jeep has sort of said, yeah, we want it to compete on the suburban level. So it's going to be a little bigger, I think. Jeep, of course, won't confirm any of this, but it's not bad conjecture. It's been out there for quite a while. You're going to find that the vehicle that actually replaces the Compass and the Patriot is going to be Dart based, and probably will have the V6. Like, all this information has just been out there.
What about the diesel?
The diesel's coming in the Grand Cherokee already.
So Alonzo says that the
where is it? He says the Grand Cherokee. Okay, it will get the, you're right. So it just says the Grand Cherokee will get the diesel.
Yeah, and hopefully, the hope is that since the physical engineering to put that 3-liter diesel in the Wrangler has been done, you can get that engine in the Wrangler in Europe, and now that they've done the hurdle of bringing that engine to the U.S. market in the Grand Cherokee, they'll get kept. They'll get you know, chocolate in their peanut butter, and all of a sudden we'll have a diesel Wrangler to talk about.
All right. And what about the Chris? Have you heard anything about a 3.2 V6? Milanzo says it's going in. It could go into the Cherokee.
That, you know what? I think that should be like an upper engine model, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing fours as well. I don't know exactly how big that's going to be, but if it's only the size of the Dart or thereabouts, because the Dart, you know, that's a modified Fiat Alpha platform, and that's already been pushed and pulled every which way. It's longer, it's wider. I don't know that they would bother to do that again. So if it's about that size, I think, you know, a nice four would probably do the job pretty well and help out with CAFE and all that other stuff.
All right.
So that's kind of what I would expect to form the bread and butter of the line. I just hope that it still has some off-road capability, because that's something that the Cherokee really had, and the market is completely lacking in sort of the bare bones, basic and honest off-road capable.
No, that's not true. You can get a Liberty now with the shameful 3.7 liter V6, and
as I was saying, I mean, you can get an Xterra, which is still honest and rugged, but that thing is like $25,000 to start, and I don't know that that's. I'm thinking of something like the Dacia Duster, like that sort of honest, basic, you know, very space efficient, boxy, simple. I don't know how much money there is in those, but I got to believe that with the volume that they used to turn out with the Cherokee, that if they did something, you know, simple and affordable, that people would turn out for it in a way that they haven't really for the Liberty or any of these smaller and more awful Jeeps of recent years.
I think that the market has moved on quite a bit from the original, the XJ Cherokee, too. So something that basic would have a hard time. You know, they'd have to have upper level model with the leather seats and the
yeah, and that's fine. But I mean, look at how much mileage they're getting out of the Wrangler. Speaking of basic, and I mean, unfortunately, the Wrangler is not cheap anymore. But that thing, you know, it's way better than it used to be. But it still rides like an ox cart. It still has horrible noise, vibration, and harshness.
Really? And I thought it's been
it sells
significantly.
It sells well. It is right, but it's still terrible, and it still sells really well. And I mean, you know, that's an icon, and you can't mess with that. But it's something that still has a quality to it, and it's still a Jeep, and it's something that's obviously resonating with buyers. But I think that if you could offer them a little bit more stability or a little bit less pricey, you know, for the for a two box configuration without a roof that comes off, I think you'd have something.
Right. All right, let's move on to the Land Rover, or the Range Rover. The price tag came out, and it starts at $83,500, but then it can quickly get well over $100,000. So my first question on this one was, I saw that in other countries, Chris, that it's starting much higher, even though the like, for example, in England, it was $97,000, and it's you know, the their dollar,
the pound.
Yeah, the pound. It's worth a lot more than the U.S. dollar. I forgot.
Yeah, and it's not unusual for UK vehicles to be priced a lot more, even just beyond the value-added tax, which is hugely costly, and I think poised to go up shortly. I actually was just in the UK for the launch of this thing, not to drive, but to see it for the first time and go through the backgrounders and all that sort of stuff. And I knew that it was going to be more expensive. I think, honestly, $83,500. For what will probably come in a base model is, I don't want to call it a good value, because an $80,000 off-road SUV kind of thing, that's still sort of absurd territory. But that seems like a pretty fair shake for this.
That's not as nuts. It's almost, I was surprised when I saw it. I was like, that's not as stupid as I thought it would be for that. But I honestly, with with Rovers, I've gotten to this point where, like I was saying earlier about the $90,000 Boxster that didn't seem nuts, anytime I step in one of these now, I go, how much is it? What? Because the alternative is, again, you look over at the Porsche and you go, or you can have a Cayenne. And I'd rather have the Cayenne.
Well, right, but if you look at this vastly, vastly different vehicle than the one it replaces, yes, I mean, I know you had it fairly recently and you were nonplussed by it, or you were unhappy with it. This is a totally different kettle of fish. I don't really care for the styling. I'll be the first to tell you, even in person, I'm not convinced with some of the changes they've made.
I think Ford did a great job on the Explorer.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And those two were in development about the same time. I remind everyone, and they were, you know, at that point the same company. I'm not crazy about the way it looks, but the amount of engineering that went into this vehicle, this doesn't happen terribly often, but we sit through a lot of press conferences, and a lot of them are very, very detailed, especially the European ones. And usually you just, your eyes kind of glaze over, you're tired, you're jet lagged or whatever, and you, but every once in a while, like once every few years, you just kind of sit there and take it all in and you go, holy crap. That, you know, it's an amazing the amount of work and the advancement that went into the vehicle. Well, I had one of those holy crap moments at the press conference.
That seems really dangerous. Like, I've had moments that involve crap with Land Rovers and Range Rovers. That's fine. But, like, when they try to advance, they typically end up, like, that's a Gomer Pyle move for that brand.
They have to do it. I mean, and I don't think it's Gomer Pyle to go to an aluminum architecture and drop 700 pounds or as much as 925 pounds. That's just smart.
No, I mean, that's
they've
fine.
Done that. They've done that in, you know, they've got plenty of experience with Jag for over 10 years doing that.
It just tends to frighten me when you say things like the amount of engineering that's gone into the Range Rover, and I'm going, oh, the engineering that's already in it was bad enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely had some issues, but I think really the core stuff that we've had issues with beyond the uncertain reliability has been like the center stack technology. I haven't heard of anybody really troubled by or befuddled by the air suspension or the terrain response or any of that stuff. All that stuff to me works beautifully, and I'm still, you know, a big believer in the vehicles. I don't know that I could recommend one because I have this, you know, fear of their long-term reliability or even their short-term reliability, and that's something they've been working to address.
I think they've been successful to a certain degree with that too. I mean, they've gone way up on the halfway meaningless JD Power stuff and all that. So
they're very happy to talk to you about that. I don't really put a whole lot of stock in that. I want to see longer term, and just even anecdotally, when people get press cards, like I want to have ones with no problems, which I think part of the issue is, and they acknowledged that with some of their models that they had a lot of first year issues, usually like stuff related to the nav screen and some other electrical issues. And we tend to see first year models because that's when we drive them, when they're brand new. And they claim to have made real strides. And, you know, frankly, I haven't been around them enough when they're later on to know whether they've kicked those problems. I think we all know that their infotainment stuff still needs a lot of work.
Yeah, well, and they're sort of stuck because we'll complain about it on the one hand if it's not there, and we'll complain about it on the other hand if it's sort of implemented poorly and they don't have the money. I mean, I was complaining about Cadillac Q last week, and clearly General Motors has lots of money to throw at it, and if they can't make it,
all the brands, whether you're talking Bentley or Ferrari or Land Rover, or I mean, obviously Land Rover is bigger than Bentley and Lamborghini.
Well, but Land Rover doesn't have Volkswagen behind them.
Those guys all have terrible infotainment systems. terrible. It doesn't matter how many times Ferrari tries to rework their system. It doesn't matter what Lamborghini does. They're all behind the curve. Even if you go to like the new Mulsanne, it's basically a generation old Audi system, and they don't even get the cool stuff with like the gesture pad. It's always behind. And so that's not why you buy a car like that. That's not why you buy a Maserati. You buy it for the rest of the experience, and you just kind of, I guess you just accept it. And people hold on to these cars for a surprising amount of time. Land Rovers compared to like a 7 Series or something like that, where a lot of them are leased. And I think, if you're coming out of a car that's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, another Rover, and then you step into one of these, you're going to be pretty gobsmacked about the change.
Yeah, the windows will work.
The one thing about the price tag to me that stood out was like, yeah, it's $83,000, but like, so is an A8 or a base 7 series.
Yeah, I'm
so. This is their top of the line model.
And with how much this does, and now that it actually seems to have more of a usable back seat, this is I know that they said that Land Rover owners tend to have a bunch of other cars in their driveway, but this is the car that they use every day, and I totally buy that. I mean, assuming you don't have any issues with reliability, I would be chuffed to drive one of those every day.
Yeah, well, and I think too that looking at it, it's what, like a $3,000 increase over the outgoing model base price. That's pretty good when you're considering the expense of aluminum construction, which it's not just the raw material, and it's everything from forming to bonding to joining and all of that stuff. It's significant in terms of the cost that it adds for a niche vehicle like that. If you're Volkswagen and you're cranking out aluminum Polos or something, that's different. But when you're Range Rover making one model out of this, and you hold your price increase to $3,000 per model, and you change a bunch of stuff, I think that's there are some impressive aspects to it. I'm still not sold on the styling, and we'll have to wait and see if I end up punching the dashboard in this one.
And I wish I could tell you that I got the chance to mess around with that system and see if it's any better. Unfortunately, I didn't. But I will tell you that the interior is greatly simplified. They dropped the switchgear by like 50%. And it's just, it's a stunning interior. I can't think of a $80,000 car that has a nicer feeling cabin.
And they're going to have a diesel. So,
well, they're going to have, they'll have diesels. They're not bringing a diesel to the States.
Oh, I thought they were. Actually,
no, you get the 5-liter, same deal, the 5-liter and naturally aspirated or the supercharged, but they have a diesel hybrid that they've announced for Europe.
That's and expensive.
I'm sure it will be. And what's amazing about it, though, is like they've done all the standard Land Rover stuff, like with that hybrid. Like the waiting depth on this thing is up, I think, 20%, and it's like over 30 inches. And you can go waiting in a hybrid over 30 inches deep, and
you just can't do it in salt water.
and you can balance. Balance the car on the rock shield that has the battery underneath it, and it's fine. They've done all these horrible torture tests, and they claim you just drive it the way a normal Rover drives. So
that's cool.
Yeah,
I'll be happy that they can send me one. I'll torture test it.
I want to try the 29 speaker 1700 watt audio system. That just sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, I'll agree with there.
I don't even know where you put. I was trying to figure it out in my head where you put 29 speakers, and I mean I have no idea.
I would put them all next to each other, but I'm not a speaker guy, so I would use a ton of tweeters. Yeah, little ones. All right, let's move on to the Q&A. The Q&A seems pretty animated today. When is Lincoln going to realize they need a flagship sedan that is not a rebadged Ford? That's from Doug in California.
Do they, though? Do they?
Yeah, I think they will eventually. I don't think they can afford to do it right now. I kind of look at the progression where they're going with a volume car like the Z, and seeing if they can really rebuild a business case around Lincoln. Because Lincoln's right now, I think Automotive News says it's 4% of their volume, or roughly like that. And 4% is a tiny amount to have to support a whole brand a dealership infrastructure, advertising, and all that sort of stuff. They need to get some sales first. They can't launch with a $100,000 flagship with nothing below it, and expect to sell at a reasonable volume and for people's minds to be changed.
And the MKX is a pretty good car. Like, don't get me wrong, it's a much better Lincoln than it is a Taurus SHO. So, that's still there if you want to. I go back and forth with Lincoln. I don't want to say that they need to do retro, but I the Lincolns that I love are those mid '60s.
Yeah.
From '58 when the first unibody Lincolns, and then through the '60s up into the Mark III and IV of the '70s. Like, those to me, that's Lincoln. When I think of Lincoln, that's what I think of, and they can't go back to that sort of long hood, short deck, personal luxury car. That market doesn't exist anymore. But they've got to have something with a little bit more panache, and I don't think the MKX has it, but at its core, it's a very good car. So if it's something like a new body styling top hat kind of thing on top of that car, because the interior is already very nice, it drives pretty well, it's roomy, so it does hit a lot of the same notes as something like the XTS that we've all recently raved about does. I don't see that as being a horrible sort of flagship step up above the MKZ. So, I don't know. They'll figure it out. Or not. I'd be giving up.
So you guys were raving about the XTS?
By the way, hi, Cadillac. I know you guys listen. So, I like the XTS. I think it's really pretty. I really like the interior.
It's really pretty.
Hate Q.
You know what? I like Q more than I expected. There are some things about it that I'm not crazy about. And I had an XTS briefly a couple of weeks ago. And, it drives like a nice classic Cadillac with a bit more body control.
It drives like a Buick LaCrosse.
I still am not happy with the way that car looks, especially the rear three-quarter.
Really? Nice.
It has, like, the overhang is like the wheelbase of a Smart. It's ridiculous.
But the old cars had overhang, too.
Yeah, but they disguised it better. This does not look good.
Here's my thing. I was desperate to drive both the XTS and the ATS when I was still at Autoblog, and I love Cadillacs and I always have. So it's like, I was like gearing up to that moment because it's been a couple of years, and then right as things timed out like badly, so I never got the chance to drive either one of the two. So I went to the place where you have to pick up the car today, and I saw like 10 XTS models lined up, and I was like, well, I'll see if I could charm my way into one of those instead. And she wasn't having it. She's like, no. I was like, so when can I? When do you think I can expect to be able to get in one of these? She's like, in the future. It's going to be a while. It's going to be a long time.
In the future.
It's like
she chewing on gum at the same time?
She's like, it's booked for 2 months solid. So, yeah, it's pretty popular. So you'll have to get on the wait list. I'm like, oh, okay, never mind.
Yeah. No, the thing I don't like about Q is the same thing I don't like about the damn buttons in the Lincoln. It's just, it's unresponsive. And I got to jump around menus to do more than one.
So, Dan, the chances are that you were going to like Q or what?
I was really interested to try Q because I'd heard good things, and I was pretty disappointed with it.
You know what I do like is the TFT display and how configurable that is.
The gauges, you mean?
Yeah. And then how you can manipulate that with the different functions, like even the traffic warnings and stuff like that with just the steering wheel redundant controls. Yeah. I think that's really slick. And I also really liked the vibrating seat feature for cross-traffic alert and for blind spot.
That scared the daylights out of me. I was like, what the hell is that?
I think that's a very smart system, and it was actually, it didn't cry wolf. It was surprisingly effective. But the main screen stuff, I'll totally agree with you. That sort of haptic feedback doesn't work all the time.
I like the haptic feedback. It's not responsive, and that's the problem with it. If you can make it responsive, fine, I'll accept it. But until then, no. I also like the head-up display. I think all cars should have head-up displays.
And it is a handy feature, especially in sport or luxury cars.
Yeah.
I think it's because there's so many things that you can look at in a luxury car that there's something that should keep your eyes on the road.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the next one. With the upcoming debut of the
of the Grand Wagoneer, do you think there's any hope that the Durango will stick around?
No.
I think there's hope that it'll stick around as long as it sells in a reasonable number that they can make money on. I don't see any problem with that. Do I think that there'll be another generation after this? Probably not. And that's a bummer. I mean, the Durango now, to me, is a really good vehicle and a really good value. And so I'm kind of bummed out about that going away.
But it's not going to go. I mean, it's not going to go away. It's going to become a different model. Like, they're going to build the same basic vehicle with a different name and different styling.
It's kind of a different price. All right, so let's go to the next one. Not a question, just a comment. Dan, you're doing a great job, and I've listened to the podcast 2 weeks ago, and I actually felt sorry for you when you're joking, saying, I'm trying. Come on, people, he hosts and does the editing. This is true. Cut him slack. He's just as good as Chris.
No, I'm not, though. See, that's the thing. I will say no. I appreciate the empathy. I didn't think that people had empathy for me.
You know, Dan, I think you're very hard for you're hard on yourself, because I've listened to a few of them. I haven't listened to all of them, I'm not going to lie. But you've done just fine.
I'm touched.
You're consistent. All right, so it seems like Chrysler is really turning the corner, or turning up the advertising to 11 on the Dart. They've had so many football ads last weekend that a friend of mine who hates cars told me that he was considering giving one a chance, just because the ads have gotten me going. Don't know why either. Is the Dart the new Neon? Runaway success. Also, because a question about the Dart would be nothing without these four characters, SRT4. And this is from Nick in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Nick, we don't know if it's a sales success yet. I just saw my first Dart on the dealer lot the other day. So we'll hedge our bets with the famous, that remains to be seen.
I've heard that phrase somewhere before.
Yeah, it could be a sales success. I like it a lot. I drove it a while back, and I thought it was a nice driving car. All the criticisms that you'll find about it are pretty accurate. But in general, out on the road, you know, it's a nice car. It feels like a more luxurious vehicle than you'd expect it to be, you know, especially when you option it up. So I like it. I think it's a competitive product. Not like a Caliber.
All right. So this next question is from RMT1. Congratulations on podcast number 300. Did you have any doubts about the podcast reaching this milestone, or did you think that it was a sure thing that would definitely have a strong following with Autoblog readers? Any chance the podcast will eventually move to a video format similar to Autolines? This is where Dan tells you don't want to see his face.
Yeah, that's pretty much true.
Am I right? Is that what you're going to say?
Well, I mean, you spend the podcast picking your nose and, like, examining the results, so clearly nobody wants to watch that.
No, and we'd have to wear pants, right? So
I'm actually wearing pants, but Zach is the one who gets in, like, a onesie before the year.
That is excellent.
My family's all waking up right now as I'm laughing out loud and thinking, wow, we really didn't miss the podcast this time.
He's going to get so angry at me for that.
I would say I definitely had my doubts that we would get to 300, but those doubts go way, way back to the early days when it was just John and me, well before it became this thing that you all made it, that you and Dan made it. I think, you know, we talked about this at 250 or 200, but it's really the following you guys have built up and the consistency with which you deliver a good product that's engaging in a way that we could never deliver when it was just John and me in the early days is staggering.
And what's with you guys getting a sponsor?
I think Kylie. Dave Kylie put that together for us.
He did a bang up
job.
Was he waiting for me to leave, or?
No, I think that took a little while.
Fire Rap was waiting for you to leave.
We don't like that chunk guy. I had nothing to do with that. Nothing at all. I know I talk about tires all the time. I even mentioned Tire Rack before. I had nothing to do with it.
It had to love the fact that you're so tire obsessed.
Yeah.
It didn't hurt.
Probably not. I mean, there was a time where the podcast did got shut down, and then we decided to do it. You, me, and Sam, we decided to start it back up, and we did it for just because we enjoyed doing it. And then it sort of it grew from there when we started doing it very regularly. So, you know, we'll keep it going. I do like the idea of the audio-only podcast better just because I think, and I'll lift a line from public radio, I think the pictures are better on an audio-only kind of thing. So, there.
Yeah, it'd be a lot more work to do the video when with it, Dan.
I also like to be an international man of mystery, where people are like, "Wow, you don't look anything like I expected you to look."
You don't look anything like that mouse that talked in the movie with Gina Davis.
Yeah.
I wasn't being mysterious there. I just really don't know the name of the movie.
Was that Beetlejuice?
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
No.
That was Jessica Rabbit.
Jessica Rabbit. Nope. Don't remember. Still don't remember. Never going to happen. I've probably watched it with the kids 20 times.
Two words that I can make chunk of, or two phrases. Let's see if I can combine them. Jessica Rabbit, rear three quarter. Does that work?
No. The no cartoon zone. What do you think?
It's 51. It's not
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how much did you miss having me on the show?
I miss having you on the show because hosting is hard, man. You're good at it.
Yeah. You know what the funny thing is, for like the first 3 or 4 episodes, every night, every Monday, I was like, it kept happening over and over again. I was planning my day around having everything done by 10 o'clock, and then around 9 o'clock, it just kept, like, you know, you do it, you don't think about doing it, but you do it so many times, it just, you're like, just relax. That's happening.
Kind of sad, a little single tear in my eye.
Hey, we should wrap this up. The Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com. Check them out for tires and brakes and wheels and all kinds of other good stuff. Again, TireRack.com, it's Autoblog podcast. So you can find us on iTunes. Also, podcast at Autoblog.com. Please leave us some feedback and let us know. And so from there, you guys back?
Yeah, I am here.
All right, what was that?
I will not be back next week, but it was nice coming in as a guest, as Chris Shunk, not a spokesperson, and I'm not getting paid for this, so FYI. It was just coming in just for fun, just like the old times. So
it sound like a political ad, and I approve
it. No, and it was a good time. It was cool. It was good talking to you guys again.
Yeah, you should not be a stranger. You know, we'll have you on when you can tell us about the new stuff that GM is coming out with.
That'll be never.
Never.
If I get Mark Royce's job, which is the day after never.
Can you get Mark Royce to come on the podcast?
I wouldn't know. Seriously, if I'm like, hi, I'm the IT guy, and he's like, oh, fix my laptop. And I'd be like, actually, we'd like you on the podcast. He'd just kick me out. I never met the guy. I have no idea what he's like. But, yeah, it's not going to happen.
All right.
Talk to your friends at GM Communications. They'll know.
You guys
know more people at GM Communications than I do, so talk to them.
So, all right, we're done. I wrapped it up and killed it.
And then exhumed it and killed it again.
Yeah.
Well done.
So we are done.
Time.